In addition, it might be interesting to know that there are good opportunities for cooperation between the two nations in Italy by employing the services of Iranian knowledge-based firms. These plans were set in place on the sidelines of Iran's Health Expo, where Italy held one of the largest foreign pavilions. The 23rd International Exhibition of Medical, Dental, Laboratory and Pharmaceutical Equipment, dubbed the Iran Health, was held in May. Dimension technologies are grabbing the spotlight with numerous new applications. An Iranian group of researchers has built a three-dimensional scanner that can scan the entire body in a fraction of time. Exciting. The scanner collects information from the body using infrared radiation. It takes only a minute. The scanner captures the position of the body in reality and registers data translated to virtual reality through a light or laser beam. Its developers say the technology gives doctors an exact image of their patients, allowing them to study it without testing the patient directly. Earlier this year, Iran's Nanotechnology Innovation Council held an exhibit in the capital Tehran, displaying the country's latest developments in the nanotech sector. Nearly 50 new products and services in medicine, industry, construction, and the environment were presented at the four-day event. Over 800 nanoproducts are currently produced in the country by roughly 450 science-based and industrial companies. Well, that brings us to the end of the programme for today. Thank you for tuning in this week. I am Samson Seas, Captain of the Seven Seas. Sees you in the next bazaar.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Lovely listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Muslim Lady. In the studio with me, I have the privilege and honor of being joined by Sister Salma Khalfan. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
Thank you so very much for being with us, sharing your time with us.
The pleasure is mine.
Thank you. So on the previous episode, we were trying to rediscover, actually, the different aspects of motherhood and how a woman, how a determined, strong Muslim lady can find her identity. Because oftentimes I feel like a lot of the mothers I see, because number one, like you said on the previous episode, there is no like monetary value placed on motherhood, right? And in today's age, everything is measured by how much money it earns us. That's the value we place on it. But there's no such thing happening with money. I mean, it's quite the opposite. You got to spend a lot of money to be a good mom.
I guess so. But when the conviction is there that Allah will give you bighayri hisab, it becomes such a pleasure, you know?
Mm.
And He does.
Without
There's so many examples I have near, you know, like myself, that I feel that when children are coming, the parents want to provide them the best schools and they're worried about the fees.
So much,
and you see, lo and behold, the risk is increasing, so that we just realize that how did our children grow up with the best kind of education,
Mashallah.
Which we really wanted for them to have. And we see that in front of our eyes. So everything is promised by Allah, the risk of the bodily risk, the spiritual risk, and also the intellectual risk. But you have to channel that in the right direction.
Of course, yes. That's so important. It's so important that you said it's already there. You just got to channel it. And how most, if not all of it, is a matter of perspective. Because I think another aspect other than the whole money thing that makes a woman feel like she's losing her identity and sense of self through becoming a mother is that it's so underappreciated. And I understand that a lot of that support hasn't directly come from her spouse, because at the end of the day, no one can encourage her as much as the father of her children.
Yeah.
But let's assume a situation where that's not happening as much as it should, or it is, but she still feels lost. What can a woman do, a mother do, to strengthen that identity and be able to appreciate what she's doing for her children?
You see, the thing is, like, when we think that, okay, she's using all her time and energy for the child, it doesn't mean that she should not regard herself also in the process. So while she's doing it, she should allocate her own time, the me time that we usually call it, in a way to enhance the child to learn. Mm-hmm. For example, if the me time is the spirituality time, she feels like reading the Holy Quran often. And now the baby has come, you know, in olden times, I remember the parents used to say, I don't even have time to pray. That's completely wrong. I've heard that myself and I was so amazed and I was so sad about it. I felt that how come we all did that, you know, but them thinking that they couldn't do it because they were so, you know, like busy doing the child upbringing, and that's where they're lost, you know. They don't realize that these things are actually teaching the child and getting that good energy for them, you know, that positive energy. The spiritual energy is so strong that in the house, the Holy Quran is being recited, prayer is, you know, like enacted. The child will learn to sit near the prayer mat. Mm. And she or he will learn also to do a sajda at a very young age. See? So all these things need to be inculcated. And that it becomes a pleasure, you know, for the parent. So the parent doesn't lose out on anything. If they are smart parents, they can get their walk, and they can even give that time to the child. They can talk to the child. In fact, they can talk such good things, read stories to the child. So the time is, you know, and the parent, you know, they learn how to be creative even. You know, there's a hadith that is a very beautiful hadith that says, if you practice what you know, Allah will teach you what you don't know.
Beautiful.
Yeah. So a parent is the most vivid example of such a case that I remember myself also. Just instinct tells me, do this, do that, you know. Like, for example, when they're sick, why don't you try this? Why don't you try? A voice like telling you. So it's a very beautiful experience, especially when you see the results that, oh, I did it. You feel a sense of achievement.
Mashallah.
And then you see your child happy. And that gives you such a deep satisfaction that I think no money in the world and no degree in the world and no working outside in the world with the co-mates or whatever, the workers, that friendship that you have, I mean, that couldn't replace that. Only one has to experience it to know it, I guess.
Mm.
So parents out there, you know, lag behind because they themselves have a complex about motherhood, as we'll keep on seeing how many qualities it improves for her to help her in this world and also the hereafter, which is the everlasting life.
Yes, yes.
And which we want for ourselves, betterment, and our children. Always the thought of getting the betterment of the hereafter, the abadi world, the eternal world should be in our mind also as we pass on through this stage of parenthood.
That's such an interesting way of looking at it. How you explain that not only can she establish a strong, wholesome, healthy identity within motherhood for herself, but by doing so, by strengthening her identity, she can be a good role model for her children.
That's right.
You do the things that you enjoy doing within the framework of your value system, and then through the years, you're going to see how it manifests in your child.
Yeah, and gives you such a reward.
It reminds me again of that hadith from Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam, where he says, don't invite people to religion just through your tongue and your words, but rather your actions.
Yeah.
And that's what a mom is doing.
Yeah.
And the essence of it all, just by being a good person and a good Muslim lady, she is automatically being the best mom she can be.
That's right, absolutely.
That is so wonderful.
And then when we go and see when she's doing this in the process, she's becoming so humane.
Mashallah.
You know, and that humanity, when it seeps inside a person, that's when actually what Allah really wants from us, becoming a human being. In other areas, she will see the fruit of it with her husband, with the people around her that care and, you know, that support among her friends, among her parents. And you must have heard this often, that when a girl gets married and gets children, that's when she realizes how much her parents worked for her.
For sure.
Yeah, that's the time she realizes that, oh, my parents took so much trouble for me. And that's when she has that worthiness of the parents more than she had when she was a spinster. So this brings about, because it's a process of humanity. Allah wants her to grow through this. And but she is, it's a sad thing that, again, like, if they don't realize their position, the heavenly position,
mashallah,
then they are so mistaken and they're so limited to this, just this world, you know.
Yeah. By raising a child and helping them grow, you are growing yourself.
Yeah.
And the sense of gratitude you're developing throughout the journey, and the appreciation you have for all the people who, you know, once aided you through this path when you were, you know, nothing but a helpless little toddler. How patient moms
are. Yeah, that's
another
factor, you know, to be talked about, like patience grows in you. All these things are, they're part of the life. Every moment is a test, right? Patience is an ingredient that is so important in everyone's lives, be they Muslims or non-Muslims, be they parents or non-parents, or, you know, like they're just growing people, like youth. So they need this patience in every step of life. Even if we want a pleasure, it requires a patience.
True.
For example, if you want to have our food, patient and wait, that self-control, it's so sweet. And Wallahu yuhibbu sabirin, Wallahu yuwaffa sabiruna bighayri hisab.
He loves the patience.
Yeah, like he gives a reward bighayri hisab. And
more
in Allah, ma'as sabirin, Allah is with the, not we are with. And
beautiful.
That's a beautiful thing. When Allah is with you, he takes the first step that I want to be with you. So patience is a very beautiful thing. It just requires a little exercise, you know, in life. And that exercise is given through what? Parenthood, the Muslim lady.
Wow.
Yeah.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
The Muslim lady, if she knew her worth, she would just keep on, you know, doing the best day by day, day in, day out, and feel that and raise to the perfection.
That's definitely true. If she's reminded, do you think that we should create, as a society, as a community, as a Muslim community, we should create more windows where our Muslim sisters are reminded of their valuable status as mothers or just as practicing Muslim women? And are we doing that enough, really, reminding them? Because God knows media is doing a lot of reminding,
right.
Of, you know, how you should hashtag be living your best life, and you should be a girl boss, and you should have all the money, and should be competing with the men,
and
feminism, and be popular. And the world is reminding them so much of this. Are we doing enough to remind them of the value Allah has placed for them?
Unfortunately, no. But yeah, there are some communities who try their best, like to, you know, promote this the value of parenthood. Okay, giving lectures and everything is not enough, I feel. But like setting up competitions, challenges, that which mother, you know, plays with the child every day. You know, mark that up. Send it for us. Or which mother, for example, does her spiritual devotions near her child so that the child can see and learn. And that should be in such a beautiful manner that when the child, you know, feels that positive energy, it's not as if that, you know, like when a person is praying and the child kind of grabs the veil or the chador of the mother, then the mother distracts him and things like that. No, it should be done with proper equilibrium, peace, happiness, pleasure, like the Holy Prophet, you know, when Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein were on his back, he waited. He waited and, he prolonged his sajda. And that was a very sweet gesture. And that was teaching us, his ummah, that, you have to do even some things like this to encourage your children to love doing this. Mm. When you take them to the mosque, after that you take them to the park so that they can feel there's a treat.
Yes, it becomes a core memory for them.
It is, yeah.
And they associate those wonderful feelings with going to the masjid and watching grandma or mom pray. Yeah. Something else, we can't constantly, I myself, criticize social media all the time. A lot of Muslim ladies out there do what you said, where they post the little accomplishments of their babies and, they give tips and hacks about how to spend quality time with each other and turn routine everyday actions, whether it's like daily prayers or, actual daily material thing, worldly things. And they post it on their social media and they encourage one another and they inspire other women.
Yeah, that's
I think that's a nice
initiative
too.
That's a beautiful
too.
Way also now that media is so prevalent, And also you're thinking of new ideas all the time. Like how they say that every 10 years new tafsirs should be written, commentaries should be written. The same way, new ideas should be thought of how to enhance this, and promote this value of parenthood, encouraging parents themselves that how, how valuable she is to her community, especially where there are communities, small communities. Bring them forward in such a way that they are an example, Mashallah. And then see that they, for example, little children have grown and how they have grown, and then they talk about it, that, what they used to do. That's the very thing. I know of a lady who is so old and she's got maybe even grandchildren, but a young girl comes up to her and tells her, how did you bring up your children?
Oh,
so people notice this
how
thing,
inspiring.
See? Yeah, how did you bring up your children that they are all like this, so great and so successful and so beautiful etiquette and things like that.
That's
so,
definitely very gratifying.
People check out these things, role
yes,
models,
they do.
And they want that to, to do it for themselves as well.
Thank you so very much, Sister Sanma. And thank you to our listeners for being with us on this episode of Muslim Lady. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
I know I'm waiting for something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zaid Al-Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih Al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah Al-Uzma Al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. So far, in everything that we have gone through in this simple book, very valuable book as well, is that we can live in anywhere, any part of the world, and uphold our religious values without compromising, and also be successful in coexisting with others and not forfeiting anything as far as our belief system is concerned. Without doubt, we do understand that animals themselves, who have been created by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, have a benefit, and they weren't created for out of vanity or for no reason. And this benefit goes back not only to nature itself, but also to us human beings. Of course, when you're trying to analyze, you know, why you have a rooster, why do you need to have a sheep, and all these things, there are many interpretations and explanations that we're able to give. You know, I think one of the most important things that we can look into is that balance of, for example, the deer, the rooster, you know, being accustomed to calling out, that would be a good thing because it's an early riser, and you become an early riser. You know, cats are usually dealing with insects and rodents and things like that, keeping the house clean and, you know, keeping everything intact as far as all of these things are concerned. But then we have the other side, and that is an animal that should not be kept, an animal that should not become a part of your family, and that is a dog. Now, of course, in today's society, when we talk about dog in a reprehensible way, in a negative way, people become very, very offended, especially dog lovers. They become very offended. And I think one of the interesting things that we are able to understand in Islamic heritage is that dogs have been used by Muslims for centuries and centuries. You know, al-kalb al-saluqi, you know, which we always read about and study about in ahkam, in fiqh, you know, talking about the hunting dog and the pure Arabian bred dogs that in today's world are not only very, very unique and beautiful, but also very expensive as well. So, you know, dog keeping is not something foreign to Islam, nor is it something that Islam completely objected and rejected. But in the culture, when it does come to who is man's best friend, in some cultures it's the dog, in some cultures it's the hawk, in some cultures it's the horse or the camel, and so on and so forth. So when a dog is spoken about in that sense, in being najis, in not being allowed to become a part of the family and things like that, it needs to be understood in the correct way. But here we are able to see from the ahadith from Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, again, the main point of observing of three important fundamental concepts. Number one, as Sheikh Jawadi Amuli says, nadhafa, cleanliness. Number two, tahara, it being pure, and or you making sure that you are observant of issues of tahara and najasa. And number three, hygiene as well, which means that you shouldn't allow, for example, animals to lick the or eat from the same utensils that you are going to be using for your consumption.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatih al Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatih al Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment.
There are many lessons
of the book
by those prophets. And
eat, take some in your hand, and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Here one hadith as far as the animal that has been censured in Islam, which is of course in this case a dog. Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, he says, La tadkhulu al-malaika baytan fihi suratun. Angels will not come into a house which has a surah. Here, surah does not mean image. It does not mean a picture. Surah here means statues or idols. وَلَا كَلْبٌ, nor will angels enter into a house that has a dog. وَلَا جُنُوبٌ, nor will it enter into a house where there is a person in the state of janabah. تَنَزَّهُ عَنْ قُرْبِ الْكِلَابِ, as another hadith says. And we are able to understand that when it does come to this whole issue of animals, you're able to keep a dog if it's a shepherd dog, if it's a security dog, if it's a hunting dog, if it's, for example, a guiding dog. You know, in these cases, it's okay, it's permissible. Even though the animal, the dog, still stays najis, you still need to observe cleanliness, tahara, and hygiene. But it will be permissible from a shari'i perspective for you to be able to use. And in such a case, of course, you know, you're still going to be observant of all of the other ahkam and issues as well. And so there are certain animals that would be good for you to keep. There are certain animals that would be reprehensible for you to keep. And in the case of a dog and also a pig. Pig goes without saying, of course. You cannot have a dog purely for the sake of it being a pet. And if you do have a dog for those four reasons that we mentioned, then, of course, you still need to remember that you need to be observant of issues of tahara and najasa and cleanliness and hygiene. And, of course, you're still going in any circumstance to respect and honor the animal. And we're going to be mentioning a lot of things, even when it comes to a dog, how Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi used to deal with dogs as well. Inshallah, we will continue on speaking about benefiting from animals in the next segment. Walhamdulillahi rabbil alameen, wa salatu wa salamu ala sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast to the
hear the children's cries.
That was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
In the limelight.
What is happening in Masafer-Yatam is not only the largest ethnic cleansing scheme to be carried out by the fake regime of Israel since 1967, but the move should be considered a first step in a much larger scheme of illegal land appropriation, ethnic cleansing, and official mass annexation. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Ramzi Barud, journalist. This article is published under the heading "The Ethnic Cleansing of Masafer-Yatam: Israeli Regime's New Annexation Strategy in Palestine." Here's more. The Zionist regime Supreme Court has decided that the Palestinian region of Masafer-Yatam, located in the southern hills of Al-Khalil, is to be entirely appropriated by the Israeli regime's military, and that a population of over 1,000 Palestinians is to be expelled. The Zionist regime's court decision on May 4th was hardly shocking. The Zionist regime's military occupation does not only consist of troops with guns, but elaborate political, military, economic, and legal structures dedicated to the expansion of the illegal Jewish settlements and the slow, and sometimes not so slow, expulsion of the Palestinians. When Palestinians state that the Nakba or catastrophe which led to the ethnic cleansing of Palestine in 1948 and the establishment of the fake regime of Israel on its ruins is a continuous, unfinished project, they mean exactly that. The ethnic cleansing of Palestinians from East Al-Quds and the endless torment of Palestinian Bedouins in Naqab and now in Masafer-Yatam is all indicative of the fact that this is a reality. However, Masafer-Yatam is particularly unique. In the case of occupied East Al-Quds, for example, the fake regime of Israel has made a fallacious, ahistorical claim that Al-Quds is the eternal and undivided capital of the Jewish people. It combined its unsubstantiated narrative with military action on the ground, followed by a systematic process that aimed at increasing the Jewish population and ejecting the original native inhabitants of the city. Such notions as greater Al-Quds and legal and political structures like that of Al-Quds Master Plan 2000 have all contributed towards turning the once absolute Palestinian majority in Al-Quds into a shrinking minority. With the Naqab, the Zionist regime's similar objectives were put into motion as early as 1948 and again in 1951. This process of ethnically cleansing the natives remains in effect to this day. Though Masafer-Yatam is part of the same colonial designs, its uniqueness stems from the fact that it is situated in Area C of the occupied West Bank. Thank you. In July 2020, the Zionist regime purportedly decided to postpone its plans to annex nearly 40% of the West Bank, perhaps fearing international condemnation. However, the plan continued in practice. Moreover, a wholesome annexation of West Bank regions would mean that the fabricated regime of Israel would become responsible for the welfare of entire Palestinian communities. As a settler colonial regime, Israel wants the land, but not the people. In Tel Aviv's calculation, annexation without the expulsion of the population could lead to a demographic nightmare. Thus, the Zionist regimes need to reinvent its annexation plan. Though the Zionist regime has supposedly delayed the de jure annexation, it continued with a de facto form of annexation, one that has generated little international media attention. Israeli regime firing zones occupy nearly 18% of the total size of the West Bank. It is one of the several ploys used by the Zionist regime to lay a claim on Palestinian land and to eventually, years later, claim ownership as well. Many of these firing zones exist in Area C and are being used as one of the Israeli regime methods aimed at officially appropriating Palestinian land with the support of the so-called Israeli courts. Now that the Israeli regime military has managed to acquire Masafer Yatah, a region spanning 32 to 56 square kilometers, based on completely flimsy excuses, it will become much easier in ensuring the ethnic cleansing of many similar communities in various parts of occupied Palestine. While discussions and media coverage of Israeli regime's annexation scheme in the West Bank and the Jordan Valley have largely subsided, this regime is now preparing for a gradual annexation scheme. Instead of annexing 40% of the West Bank all at once, the fabricated regime of Israel is now annexing smaller tracts of land and regions like Masafer Yatah separately. Tel Aviv will eventually connect all these annexed areas through Jewish-only bypass roads to larger Jewish settlement infrastructures in the West Bank. Not only does this alternative strategy allow the fake regime of Israel to avoid international criticism, it will also permit this regime to eventually annex Palestinian land while incrementally expelling Palestinians, helping Tel Aviv prevent demographic imbalances before they occur. What is happening in Masafer Yatah is not only the largest ethnic cleansing scheme to be carried out by the fake regime of Israel since 1967, but the move should be considered a first step in a much larger scheme of illegal land appropriation, ethnic cleansing, and official mass annexation. The Zionist regime must not succeed in Masafer Yatah, because if it does, its original mass annexation scheme will become a reality in no time.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in
gives it all away, proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day, when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, din al-Islam, din Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to talk about the rules, Islamic jurisprudential laws about the media, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And as always, our guest speaker, Sheikh Javid. Sheikh Javid, since we are talking about the media,
Is it permissible, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, to make a movie about Imam Hussein, to portray the story of his martyrdom, you know, especially the principles for which he has sacrificed his life for the sake of Islam, you know? The actor who's going to play the part or the role of Imam Hussein is not going to appear in flesh, obviously. Just a luminous person, like as is always the norm for religious movies, like they don't show the image of the face, the features, right? So just a luminous personality, all right?
Yeah.
Playing the part of the mom. Is it permissible to make such a movie?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. If the story of the film is based on reliable sources with utmost consideration of the sanctity of the subject and the integrity and status of the Imam alayhi salatu wasalam. So not only the Imams, of course, but his companions like Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas and the household of the Imam. So there is no harm in that, you know. Based on the conditions that you may, because you said that face is not depicted, and then it's the image is just luminous. There's no objection in it, you know. So it's very much important that the sanctity of the Imam, let's say, or the holy figure, is maintained, and the utmost care and precaution is exercised in depicting and also narrating the story. Grand Ayatollah Khamenei says that since it's very much difficult to tackle the subject carefully and accord due reverence to the integrity of the martyred Imam and his companions, one has to observe extreme precaution in this matter. It's very much necessary to exercise caution or precaution in regards to Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam in narrating his story using a movie, you know. And unless precaution is exercised, it's not permissible to depict the story, because it's very much likely that the picture that is shown on the TV screen may be considered as a kind of disregard to the Imam and to his companions.
You also included the companions. Do you mean by the companions? Like close companions or even the remote companions?
No, when we talk about companions, of course, we talk about his immediate relatives. Like, for example, Abu al-Fadl Abbas, Ali Akbar, alayhi salatu wasalam. And the immediate relatives who are highly respected by Shia Muslims.
I see.
Not only Shia Muslims, but Muslims, the entire Muslims, of course.
Yes. Okay, Sheikh Javid, what about Ayatollah Khamenei's view on, actors and actresses, in fact, playing each other's part? In other words, like, sometimes it is like, incumbent on the actors to wear in place of their female counterparts, like the actresses, so they have to wear like women's clothes, all right, or vice versa, for the purpose of just acting in either the theater or movie industry. What is his view on the opposite sexes mimicking the voice of each other?
Well, Grand Ayatollah Khamenei does not give a definitive answer to this question. He states that it's not, for example, remote to be permissible. So it's not a clear-cut answer. It means that it is very much likely that it is permissible for the opposite sexes to wear each other's clothes or mimic the voice of each other in acting and expressing the characters of a real person, provided that it does not cause corruption, you know. Mm-hmm. That's the condition. If it does not entail any corruption or any evil, there is no objection. And as I said, Ayatollah Khamenei does not give a clear cut answer. He says it's not remote, mm-hmm. you know, to be permissible. So it's very much, it's likely to be permissible. Mm-hmm. So
we also see it in some kind of Islamic passion plays, like out in the streets of the Muslim countries, when they want to portray, for example, the event of Ashura, you know,
you're right.
in Karbala. They show like sometimes the
men wearing women's dresses.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, you're right. So that's why Grand Ayatollah Khamenei is completely fully aware of these scenarios, and he does not forbid it. Mm-hmm. He does not forbid men wearing women's clothes in such scenarios.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much. Let's take a short break and we'll be back. Don't go away.
Sure.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about the Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and our guest speaker, Sheikh Javid. We are talking about the rules of media according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, what is the ruling in the matter of women wearing makeup just for the sake of, you know, performance, as it is somehow necessary or becomes somehow an indispensable part of any kind of film or play for women to wear such makeup? You know, they are like sometimes told by the directors to do so. So what is the ruling regarding that?
You're right, you know, women, you know, sometimes need to wear makeup to present themselves as someone who's quite different from what they themselves appear in their normal life.
Yes.
So according to His Eminence's ruling, if applying makeup is undertaken by the person herself mm-hmm. or by another woman, or by one's mahram, and it does not entail any corruption, there is no objection to that.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Ayatollah Khamenei says that if that's not the case, it's not permissible to wear makeup. And also, His Eminence says that a woman's face with makeup should be covered in front of non-mahram. And this is something, this is a matter of consensus.
Mm-hmm.
All religious authorities are of the view that women should not wear makeup in the presence of non-mahram men. And there is no precaution, there is no ihtiyat in such matters. So generally speaking, women should avoid wearing makeup in places where there are non-mahram men, seeing them with makeup, with ornaments, with things which beautify them. So women should avoid beautifying themselves and showing their beautification to non-mahram men. Of course, in the presence of their close relatives, mahram relatives, there is no objection to them wearing makeup.
But for the sake of the movie, it's completely haram, you mean?
You know, as I said, you know, Ayatollah Khamenei says that if a woman applies makeup
mm-hmm.
By, you know, for the sake of, you know, extreme, if there is, it is extremely necessary, and if it does not entail any corruption or any evil, you know. There is no objection to her doing so.
Okay, thank you very much, Javid. And thank you, my dear audience, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. We say, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم ملجا لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wa salam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam.
السلام عليك يا مولاي.
موسى بن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue.